Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Now let me ask you a question. Have you ever been close to someone who has committed suicide? Tell me, do you know what signs to look for when someone is contemplating suicide? Have you ever wanted to know about how a family can handle this traumatic event? Would you like to learn what to do and what not to do when confronted with suicide? Can you imagine what the stunning suicide statistics are? Now tell me, have you ever heard about a book called Battlefield, How My Family Survived Suicide? Or better yet, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that we're looking for? Now, are you ready to learn how to be successful and how one family dealt with suicide? If you can answer yes, or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today, I will be introducing you to my guest. He is a success coach extraordinaire, and he will provide us with informative and inspirational lessons and some really, really great advice. I am pleased to announce that our show is now live on Talk4Media at iHeartRadio with over 55 million subscribers. We are archived at iHeart for your listening pleasure. Also, LinkedIn announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed last year. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guest and the book he wrote. It is an inspirational story of a high-profile art-dealing family's journey to survive without answers after one of their sons takes his life. Shown through the realistic visions of their youngest child, now a parent himself, then just 16, it is a masterful portrayal of love, forgiveness, and acceptance, emotionally gripping with an inside look at the mysterious art world. This is a powerful family saga that will change you forever. It is my pleasure to welcome the author to our show. Hello, Carl David. How are you today?
I'm great, January. Thank you so much for having me on tonight. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, wonderful. And I've been looking forward to having you on. I've read the reviews for your book, and they're fantastic. Did I mispronounce? How do you pronounce? Is it Battlefield or Batter?
Battlefield, yes.
Battlefield. Okay, I got that right. Now, let's begin with where your story began, where you were born, and your family, what the family was like, and who your early mentors were, Carl.
I was born in 1949 in Philadelphia. I was the youngest of three children. We had an idyllic American family. We didn't have a dog, but we had everything else in the station wagon. And we were very close-knit. And I grew up in Philadelphia, went to high school there, went to college for 2 years at Temple University, got thrown out. That's a whole separate story. And I was reinstated, and then I went off to Oglethorpe College in Atlanta for my last 2 years of school and wound up on the dean's list in Spanish Honor Society, and had to prove myself at that point to both myself and to my folks. And And then I wound up coming into the family business after my college experience, and I've been here ever since 1970, full time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I want to hear all about the art world. Now, who were your early mentors when you were a child and then when you went into the work world?
Well, my folks were my real mentors. My dad, initially, for a long time, who really taught me life lessons, how to grow up, how to survive, and just how to be a wonderful human being, as was he. And my brothers also were my mentors. So, you know, I looked up to everyone as I was growing up, you know, everyone in our family. And you know, the influences really rubbed off on me, and I took all the goodness that I could see and learn, and I just kind of incorporated it into my being, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book, Baderfield, How My Family Survived Suicide, begins as a memoir and homage to your father, but it's actually much more important. Would you tell us a little bit about how long it took you to write the book and why it starts off as a homage to your father?
Sure. I mean, my dad was my hero, and we used to fly. He was a pilot as well as an art dealer, and we used to fly in and out of Baderfield in Atlantic City all the time. So I kind of felt it appropriate, since that was actually the last place that I saw him, to start the story there. Mm-hmm. And it took decades for me to write this book. I did start out as homage to my dad, and, you know, it was very painful. I lost my dad at a young age. He was only 58.
Uh-huh.
And I had a battle with myself before I could even go back to Baderfield. It was years and years later. When it was back in 2008 was the first time I was able to get back to the field and kind of go back home, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The book was flat for a long time, because until I got a publisher who gave me an editor who explained to me, we want to show your story. We don't want to tell it. So we need a dialogue.
Okay.
And they gave me a great editor, and they didn't tell me how to do it. They showed me how to do it.
Uh-huh.
And in 6 weeks, I rewrote the whole book, and it really came to life. I mean, I had worked on this thing for decades, and there were many times my wife said, you know, if it's too difficult, don't do it, if it's too painful. And I said, you know what, no, I have to do this. I have to do this for the kids we don't have yet, and I really need to memorialize my dad. And I went back and I dug in, because I had blocked out a lot of emotions, which is one of the reasons it took as long as it did, and she had said to me, my wife, who was my editor, and my soulmate, if you will, if I don't get it, your readers aren't going to get it. I'm not feeling it. So that was the blockage that I had to work through and to go back and really open up my emotions and relive a lot of pain.
Yeah. Now, when your father died, did you stop flying or did you continue flying?
Interesting question. I still had the passion. I had to sell the airplane. I had a choice of whether I keep it and I go officially get my license. I mean, I had hundreds of hours that I had logged, but never really put them into a formal, you know, position. So I had a choice to keep the plane, and one day I just took the plane out of the hangar, started up the engine, did the pre-check, pre-flight, and taxied out to the runway. And I had a split-second decision to make. Do I go up or do I not? And I was married. I didn't have kids yet. And, you know, I said to myself, what am I doing? This is crazy. I know I can do this, you know.
Uh-huh.
I decided at that point, my common sense came back to me, and I taxied her back to the hangar, and I had to sell her. So I did, and that was very painful, but it was more painful to try and fly solo without my dad.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure it would be painful to even go up and fly without your dad.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would be a very difficult thing to do. Now, you were 16 years old when suicide happened in your family. And I can understand why it took so long for you to write this or to even talk about it or think about it. Because back then, people just didn't talk about suicide, did they?
No, it was a dirty word, and it was an act that was looked upon with a jaundiced eye, and you were... even though you didn't do it, you were looked at as if you were somehow related to it, and you also had the same kind of negative feel about yourself. I mean, it's all craziness. I mean, today, you know, you if someone's got those feelings, you want to help them. You don't want to ignore them or turn your head away because it's an ugly act. Yeah, it's an ugly act for sure. But there are reasons for it, and without awareness and exposure, it's never going to change.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, fortunately, we're not in the 1960s anymore, and there's a whole different attitude and mentality toward it.
Yeah. You know, we had a suicide in our family, and basically no one ever, ever talked about it. It was never spoken of, which tells you what the mentality in the 60s was for people. Now, when you look back on it and you look at it from an adult perspective, objectively, who do you think took it the hardest, your father or your mother?
That's a tough question. I think everybody in their own right fell very hard on this. And I think my dad, obviously, it killed him 8 years later. My mother felt it the rest of her life, although she lived to be 94, and you know, we're very lucky to have her that long. But I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I think that they both suffered an interminable pain.
Yeah, I think for a parent, it's probably throughout their entire life, it's probably the last thing they think about when they go to bed at night, and it's probably the first thing they remember when they wake up. It's something that you just don't ever get over, do you?
No. You know, you only learn to live with it as best you can. You never get over it. It becomes emblematic as to who you are. I mean, you wear this thing the rest of your life. And, you know, at that point, it's a matter of what you do with it. For years, I was kind of in denial. Even when I was in college, I would just push it away and not allow it, you know, the existence of this thing that it actually happened. But you can't do that because the emotional body runs the physical body, and it comes back and smacks you right in the face. And there's just there's no escaping it. I mean, you really, you got to face it. You know, it's just something that it's part of you, and you can't deny it.
Now, you were 16. How old your brother who committed suicide? His name was Bruce, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was 22.
22 years old. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. He was so very, very young. You know, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to discuss with Carl David what kind of a state of mind his brother Bruce was in before this tragedy and some of the things that you can look for if you are dealing with someone who you think might be depressed and considering suicide. We'll be right back with Carl David.
Do you desire more control over your money and financial matters? Would you like simple solutions to complex financial topics? Do you want more security in your financial future? If you answered yes to any of these questions, the book 101 Principles to Wealth is your answer. It's available now on Amazon.com. That's 101 Principles to Wealth by Charles Brokop. Order today.
Do you want to learn how to live into your dreams? One Door Closes, Overcoming Adversity by Following Your Dreams. The new book by Tom Ingracia and Jared Kredemski captures the thought-provoking stories of 16 people from all walks of life who have triumphed over adversity to achieve their goals. Plus, you'll get 10 self-assessment tools to design your own blueprint for success. Unlock your true potential. Fulfill your dreams. Be inspired. One Door Closes is available from Amazon.com.
Well, I'm pleased to announce that Charles Brokop will be back with us next month on the show, sharing his fantastic book, 101 Principles to Success. And Tom Ingracia and Jared Kerminsky will be back with their book, One Door Closes. And their special guest next week will be Sherry Payne, who was one of the singers with the Supremes from the 1960s Motown sound. We're back right now with my guest, Carl David, and we were talking about what happened to his family after his brother committed suicide. Did your family have any clue that he was depressed or that he was even thinking about suicide?
No, we had nothing. We were totally blindsided. I mean, he seemed fine, and he was a little bit distressed about his reserve unit getting ready to be called up to go to Vietnam, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. I mean, But then again, someone who's in that frame of mind doesn't think clearly, and you know, my parents would have somehow arranged for him not to go. I mean, this was when war was being depraved. It was being shown on television with, you know, kids coming back in body bags and limbless, and I mean, it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we saw nothing, absolutely nothing. No note, you know, no signs, no clues.
Oh, and did he commit suicide at home, or did he go out and do it somewhere else?
It was actually in the gallery up on the fourth floor.
Oh, my gosh. And who found him?
My father.
Oh, wow. What an experience for your father. It's the kind of thing you never recover from. No note, no information. Do you think it might have been just depression over going to Vietnam, which I can certainly understand, because quite frankly, during that time, no one really wanted to go there.
No, this is true. Don't know. I mean, it certainly could have been one of the contributing factors. There could have been something else going on in his mind, some other demons that he was dealing with that he kept to himself.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to know, you know, and I guess even knowing wouldn't really matter because it wouldn't bring him back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, at this point. You know.
Now, did he work with your father at the art gallery?
He did. He was going to night school at Temple University, and my father was about to set up a frame shop for him on one of the upper floors of the gallery, because this was a kid who could take a car apart and put it back together again, and it would run.
Yeah.
If I did that, it would probably be laying in extra pieces.
Right, I know. Okay, so your dad finds him on the fourth floor of the gallery. What happens next? I'm sure everyone in the family must just go into complete, total, absolute shock.
Yeah, I was in high school at the auditorium in the morning assembly when I got a call up to the front of the stage saying that I had to go home. There was an emergency, and I had no clue. I thought maybe there was Bruce hadn't come home that night, obviously, and I thought maybe there were some involvement in a car accident or something. I had no clue. I mean, no way could I have seen this coming. And, you know, when I drove that day and I raced home not knowing what to expect, and, you know, when I walked in the front door, my oldest brother told me what had happened, and I just, like shock.
Yeah, yeah. How old was your oldest brother?
Alan was 25 at the time.
Mm-hmm. So Bruce was the middle child.
Yes.
Yeah. So what happened after you had this horrible tragedy? What did the family do? Did you go to counseling? How did you try to handle this tremendous trauma?
Well, initially, we had all our family and friends gather around us, and the funeral and all that. And once that's done, after a few days, people go home, and you kind of have to pull together. And, initially nobody wanted to really talk about it because we were protective of our parents. They were protective of us. And they kind of lost the will to live for a while. And my mother used to tell me that, you know, she and my father would talk and say, Sam, we have two other kids. You know, we can't just throw the towel in. We have to live for them. Mm-hmm. So they did, you know, but it took a lot of effort. It took a lot of professional help, because this is something you can't survive without. I mean, it's too big. I had the benefit of a psychoanalysis, which basically saved my life. And my parents had, psychiatric help and medical help, and sort of my brother. And, I mean, it took a long time to get back on our feet, you know, for the rays of sunshine to come back into our lives. But we realized that the circle that was five is now four, and we had to live on for ourselves and for my brother.
In his memory. And
yeah.
Your family had to be, I would imagine, proactive, because let's face it, during the 60s, getting professional help was not an easy thing. It wasn't done. If you had said you were going to a psychiatrist, people would just probably back off. Your family was proactive, and you got right to it, didn't you?
We did, and you know what? We had to. It's the only way we could have survived. And we, you know, kind of shut out the criticism of the outside world because we didn't care. We had, at that point, one job to do, and that was survival. And anyway, we knew how we were going to do it. You know, it was love, forgiveness and acceptance, basically with the three tools that we knew how to use, but we had to really dig down deep and claw our way out of darkness. And mm-hmm. every day you wake up, it starts again, you know. But
Oh, yeah.
You either quit or you survive. And, you know, we weren't quitters.
And you had each other, which is so, so important. Looking back on it, and I know you've studied and you know quite a bit about suicide, more than most of my listeners will, I hope, ever know. What are some do's and don'ts when someone has committed suicide and you're trying to deal with the aftermath?
Well, you have to be there for them as much as they'll let you in, and you have to encourage them to get help. One thing you don't do is, you know, create any kind of judgment, you know, or cast aspersions on that person or the family or anybody else, because they're going to feel like they're responsible to some measure anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they really shouldn't own that, because it's not something that you do to someone else. It's something that does that on their own. Granted, there's situations where someone's depressed and they can't see beyond that depression, and maybe they didn't take their medication, or maybe they refused to get medication, or maybe they didn't even know they were depressed. But there are lots of reasons that people take their life. And when you hear of, well, I know when we hear of something like that, it kind of reopens our own situation. So, you know, I think you have to be sympathetic, and you have to be kind, and you have to be there to help them if they want it.
Yeah, and it's so important to be non-judgmental and to try to be unconditional in your support and not be critical. Now, let's talk a little bit about medications, because back then we didn't even know or hadn't even heard the word antidepressant. And now so many people have the opportunity to get help through therapy and with prescriptions. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think that can be a lifesaver, but again, on the other side of the coin, if it's abused, it can be a killer. So, you know, those kind of things have to be dealt with professionals who deal with this kind of situation, and not necessarily your corner doctor, but someone who, you know, if there's a situation like this where there's a severe depression or a suspicion of a depression, I think you really need to go to a doctor who's schooled in that area of medicine, who can see the signs and know, you know, the proper prescription, the proper administration, dosages, and all that kind of thing, because a lot of lives have been, and I'm sure will continue to be, saved by proper medication, you know, when someone's afflicted with depression. It's an illness just like any other ailment.
Absolutely. And fortunately, I think more people are beginning to understand that. Now, when you were writing this book, which you previously said it took decades to get it, you were thinking about it and attempting to write it, did it help you heal? Was it cathartic for you?
It was cathartic. I mean, painful as it was at times, it really helped me get back to my feelings and kind of unroll this ball of emotional flying, you know, a strip at a time. And I had done that going through a psychoanalysis. But, you know, the feelings stay with you. And sometimes when it's an anniversary date, birth date, or death date, and my wife knows I did this for years, where I just kind of, like, shoved it aside and ignored it. You know, I didn't want to feel it. I mean, who wants to feel pain? But, you know, I would get headaches or stomach ailments or just not feel right. And until I allowed the feelings to surface. And I did that, and, you know, it's a learning curve. I mean, it takes years. I still don't like feeling it, but I do, and I know that it's part of me, so I can't, you know, I can't deny it. It's there.
Oh, yeah, and it always will be with you. I've shared with my listeners before that over 40 years ago, my first husband was killed during Vietnam, and even now to this day, when we get to the date, the anniversary of his death, I slip into a depression that week. I'm just kind of quiet. And it's something that you never can let go of. Don't you agree?
I agree totally. I'm sorry for your loss. And, you know, it's one of these things that these anniversary dates or certain things in life that are really fabulous, more so than horrible, bring up that gap, you know, that's in your life. I mean, when there's a great thing that occurs, I wish they were here. Well, they're here in spirit, but they're just not here physically.
Right. Now, tell me, was your mother able to read this book, and what was her reaction?
Oh, she thought it was fabulous. I mean, she read it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It brought up all kinds of pain, but, you know, she was thrilled that I was able to do this, and she thought it was, she just thought it was incredible. And every time I do another radio interview or television interview or journal interview, she would tune in, and she was one of my biggest cheerleaders, you know, and through it all, because we lived it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's wonderful that she is still alive long enough to read it. And your book is actually a celebration of a family, and it's one of these uplifting memoirs. Believe me, it is not depressing. Carl has written it to help everyone enjoy life and look forward to more adventures. You know, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back with Carl, we're going to talk about some stunning statistics on suicide that will just amaze you, and also his feeling about pay it forward. We'll be right back with Carl David.
Everyone deserves a happy life. Life is supposed to be fun. Your life is supposed to feel good, and you're meant to feel happiness in your life and to satisfy your dreams. And you can, because the only reason anyone wants anything or does anything is that they think they will feel better in the having of it or the doing of it. They think they will feel better in the experiencing of it. Coming soon, a website where you can learn more on how you can have the life you deserve at afeelgoodworld.com. Lately, there's a whining epidemic in our world. People are even whining about whining. Are you sick and tired of listening to everyone whining all the time? So was January Jones, the author of Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reached number one at Amazon.com. Ms. Jones based her book on a survey of the top 10 things that people whine about at all ages and all stages of life. January is a success coach that can tell you how to help others. When you buy Thou Shalt Not Whine, the 11th commandment, you'll find out what people whine about and how to stop them from whining. This is the perfect gift book to give or get for any occasion. Thou Shall Not Whine was voted the best gift to be given anonymously for those special people in your life. Ms. Jones is an internationally known author in the style of Irma Bombeck, specializing in housewife humor, with her book being published in Korea and China. You can find Thou Shall Not Whine at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and we're back with Carl David, and we're talking about his fantastic book, Bader Feel, How My Family Survived Suicide. Carl, could you share your website information and share with my listeners how they can get your book?
Sure. My website is www.carledavid.com. It's CarleDavid.com. Don't forget the E. There's somebody who gets very annoyed when he gets my emails and website temp. The book can be found anywhere online. We decided not to go the bookstore route, but it is a soft copy and can be found on my website. You can get it on Amazon. It's also available on the Kindle, the Nook, the Apple iBookstore, and in about 70 other different digital markets worldwide. So if you do a search for Bader Feel by Carl David, it'll come up in a million places. And I think the download is about $7.77. It might even have dropped by now. the actual physical copy used to be $16.99. I think they may be discounted as well. And I have to say, it is a very inspirational read. It's about this idyllic American family that was crushed by this horrible event, and how we all pulled together and did everything we could to survive it and move forward. And as you said before, you know, you don't forget, you don't get over it. You just learn to live with it as best you can. It really is part of something you incorporate in your soul. And, you know, it's what you do with it after that that counts.
I know. I can tell you're so passionate about this. You said, I needed to reach out to those who were on the brink of killing themselves to show them there is always a better way. There is love, hope, and help available. This book will resonate with teens and young adults who may not realize the devastation of suicide and the permanent horror it inflicts on the family they leave behind. and no truer words were ever spoken or written.
Hey, January, I got a caller for you real quick.
Okay, hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, January?
Good. And who is this?
This is Cruiser Small.
Okay. Hi, Cruiser. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to let you know what a great guest you have there. We've known Carl for several years now. He's been on our radio show as well, and he's written a very nice book. I hope everybody goes out and purchases the book. It's very inspirational, and he's done a great job with it.
Oh, well, thank you for calling in. And as he just briefly said, his book is available at Amazon, Kindle, and at his wonderful website. Carl, can you say hi to Cruiser?
Sure. Hey, Cruiser, how are you?
Hey, Carl, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. It's a great show.
Thank you.
Well, we're so glad you're enjoying it. I'm truly enjoying having Carl on the show. Carl, could you share some stunning statistics about suicide that will give us more insight into this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these will absolutely knock your socks off. In the realm of the world, there are 1 million people a year who take their life, and that number is growing.
Wow.
That's a worldwide statistic. In this country, there's one about every 16 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. In the military, one a day, and among veterans, 22 lives a day are lost to suicide. It's the second leading cause of death for teenagers, actually for kids aged 10 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
It's the third leading cause of death for college-age kids,
mm-hmm.
ages 12 to 18. More teenagers and young adults die from suicide than from cancer, heart disease, AIDS, birth defects, stroke, pneumonia, influenza, and chronic lung diseases combined.
Oh.
I mean, it's just, it's
staggering.
Out of control. It really is. It's out of control.
Yeah. I would have had no idea. I knew that there was a situation with the veterans because it's been in the forefront of the news. But to think 1 million people per year, and that's around the entire world. This is where did these? Who compiled these statistics?
Well, a lot of these come from the National Suicide Foundation, the Jason Foundation. I mean, these are real statistics, and anybody can actually look them up and find them. Unfortunately, I mean, they're out there. But on the other hand, they have to be out there because if there's no impact and there's no incentive to, you know, make a movement forward to prevent this thing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if people don't know, there's nothing they can do about it. And it's only when they have walks and they've got different charity events for suicide prevention that things get done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, for one, I mean, is a great organization.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of them like that today that, you know, that have really raised awareness and given a lot of effort and time and monies to help.
Now, you lived through it as a brother and a son, but as a father now, how has your perspective changed, and do you look at it through your father's eyes?
Yeah, I mean, as a father, I can't even fathom the concept of losing a child. In fact, we talked to our kids. We had to decide at what age it was appropriate for us to say something to them because we didn't want them to learn about my brother from anybody else.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
we sat them down when we thought they were old enough to get it, but not to be freaked out by it completely, so that it was almost as if it were an insurance policy, so that you know they would know the wrath of horror and the devastation this act leaves on a family, and that no matter what was going on in their lives ever, however insurmountable, however horrible it seemed, that we would be there for them, and that this was never, ever, ever the answer to the problem, because suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah. And it's a horrific tragedy, and it offers no solace to the lost to the family after something like this happens. It only actually increases their guilt and confusion and distress. You want to pay it forward, and how do you plan to do that?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to share our family's experience
mm-hmm.
so that someone, even one person, might read this or hear about it and decide to choose to live instead of to die. So my whole effort at this point is to pay it forward by taking the darkest days of my life and doing something to benefit others with them. I might save a life. I might save 1,000 lives. I might save 1,000,000. I don't know, and I don't really need to know. All I know is that I'm putting it out there, doing the best job that I can by taking this horrendous experience and trying to do something to benefit somebody else with it. You know, it might make someone feel, but it might help a family who's gone through it to know that we do go on, we do survive. You know, we're tainted with this after effect, but it's our obligation to go on and live our lives. And people need to know that.
I know, because when something like this happens, sharing your experience does help others. And, you know, the reality is there's no way of knowing how many people you will help. And the reality is if you can just save one life, all your efforts have been worthwhile. And it's a real homage to your brother and to your parents. Tell us a little bit about working with your father. I know you were in the art gallery with him, and you're there now. What was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. I only got to do it for I grew up with it, but, you know, after college, I had 3 years before I lost my dad, and he was amazing, and I assimilated so much of what he did, not just from listening to him, but more from watching him and emulating him. He was he was a Renaissance man. He was absolutely incredible, could do anything. And when he walked into a room, the room lit up, you know, like with fire. I mean, it was amazing. So I was very fortunate, you know, to have him for the brief time that we had him. And I wouldn't have traded it for another 30 years with someone who was just kind of a dull, you know, lackluster.
Yep. Boring.
Run-of-the-mill person. Right, boring, you know. But my father was, every minute was exciting. You never knew what was going to come next. And he was just amazing. I mean, and he gave me that inspiration in life. You know, that you need to live every minute and save a little something for tomorrow, but don't waste today in case tomorrow doesn't come.
Oh, wow. That's terrific advice. And that certainly was the mantra that he imparted to you. You know, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little more about living in the art dealer family that Carl David was born into. And we're going to talk about what success means to Carl today as we speak. And if he has any regrets, things he wished he could do over, and advice for you. We'll be right back. Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable? Someone who has touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems? People who have fearlessly shared their stories, their struggles, and their successes? People who have priceless personalities? In my new book, Priceless Personalities, Success Stories Shared by January Jones, I am honored to be able to share with you people dealing with problems such as incest, molestation, child abuse, drug abuse, polygamy, unemployment, scandal, starting over, self-esteem, and workplace issues. My guests have all been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. They will amaze, amuse, and even astonish you. You will adore getting to meet them at Amazon.com. My book is now available, 2-for-1, paperback and Kindle editions.
Are you a fitness professional, a trainer, or a coach? Would you like consistent and timely updates on your team's performance? We have a completely customizable app that can give you real-time information via the internet or your handheld phone. Track the performance of your client's progress with their physical fitness regimen. Track team members' performance or schedule a workout session. Meet up at the gym, on the bike trail, or wherever your physical activities take you. The app is called Socially Fit, or SoFit, and can be found on the iTunes Store. Look for the blue Socially Fit icon. When combined with data analysis capabilities, you not only feel the effects of your fitness routine, you also see the graphical progress of your results. The app makes the complex simple, so that more of your time is spent sculpting your physique, with less time tracking your results with old-fashioned pen and paper. Download it today to begin a new year with data to show your progress in meeting your goals. Are you socially fit?
I hope everyone listening, if you are not socially fit, I hope you will become socially fit with us this year. I'm welcoming back another priceless personality on our show, Carl David. He was born in Philadelphia, and he is the third descendant of a four-generation art dealer family specializing in American and European 19th and 20th century paintings, watercolors, and drawings. He is the author of Collecting and Care of Fine Art. Now, Carl, who was the first David that started the art dealer business in your
family?
That
was actually my grandfather, whose name was David David, and he was in this the time he was a kid as well. And then my father came along, and then my brother after that, and now myself, my wife, both our sons.
Uh-huh.
And so we are now in our fourth generation with our sons. They started out actually in New York, and then moved to Philadelphia because I think they had family here back in the 30s.
Uh-huh. Okay, and where did they come? Where did your grandfather come from? What country?
He came from Russia.
Oh, okay. Okay, I have Russian grandparents too. Okay. And how did he get into the art dealer business? Do you know his history a little bit?
Well, he had a passion for antique furniture and old jewelry and just antiquities. I don't know where that came from, but maybe there was a European influence. So they started dealing in that kind of thing, antiquities and little objects of virtu and just works of art. And my father wanted to really be a painting dealer. And I'm not sure my grandfather loved that idea because my father sort of changed the direction of the business. I mean, we're still dealing that to some degree, but my father wanted to open up and get a bigger building and just become a gallery and deal in old master paintings and French Impressionist paintings. And that's what he did. And it was really his passion. And there was a time here in the gallery when we had a Baroque concert. My father bought a Baroque concert from Channel 12, which was WHYY, the public television station. And he set up this quartet with lots of chairs and food and actually hosted a concert and in the gallery on the second floor, and we had a whole gallery filled with Baroque paintings.
Oh, how fabulous.
So
wow.
That was pretty neat.
What a neat family to grow up in. And now, did you study art in school, or did you just absorb it all working with your father in the gallery?
A little bit of both. I mean, I took some art history courses, but you know, the day-to-day life situation and having paintings brought in and out of our house all the time and going to museums and, you know, being stuck in the basement of the Louvre at lunchtime, being locked down there. those are great times and great experiences. You can't get that from books. And you know, I got a business degree from Oglethorpe College and thought that I knew enough to run the business when I came into the business. Well, guess what? You know, when you hit the streets, you can kind of throw the books away and remember some of what was in there, but the street business is a lot different than what you learn in school. So I kind of conformed to what was going on here instead of trying to change the rules. I grew up, you know. I mean, I realized that you don't change the machine. The machine changes you. And, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I learned with time. You know, I was young.
Mm-hmm. Now, define what success means to you today as we speak, and share with us if you have any regrets or advice for our listeners.
Well, the success that we've had in our business comes from hard work and it comes from dedication and persistence and taking the bad with the good and rolling with it, knowing that tomorrow's another day, no matter what happens. And life's lessons are the same way. I mean, I think you have to apply life's lessons to business and vice versa. The success that I feel, one of my major successes, I mean, the first book I wrote was Collecting and Care of Fine Art, and Crown published it for me in New York. That was back in 1981. And that was my first real foray into writing. I mean, I'd done some magazine articles and things, but, and, you know, I looked at that as success. I didn't do it for money. I did it to level a playing field for investment in art, which was a big hype at the time. And I got a lot of flack from colleagues, you know, how can I do this and you know, give out such privy information? And I said, well, you know, I can put my hand down tonight. If you can't, that's your problem. I just felt it was fair to just equal the forces out there. But the bigger success was this book at Baderfield, How My Family Survived Suicide, because it took a lot out of me. It still does when I do these interviews, but I feel it's something that I absolutely have to do. It's part of what I'm supposed to be doing. I know that to my core, and to me, this is a success. You know, when I do these things, I can't measure the after effect of how many people might be helped or how many lives might be saved. But and I don't need to measure that. I don't really need to know that. I know it somewhere in my heart that it's helping people. And to me, that's the biggest success that I can have. I mean, there are two other areas that I'm trying to work with this book, and one is to get it in every school system in America. A huge endeavor, and I won't quit until I at least have some partial success. And the other one is a film. I really want a movie because I feel that if this were in film format, it would affect so many more people. I mean, I think millions of people would be affected by it in a positive way. So I've been trying to work with some kind of venue to get it made into a film, and I won't quit until I do.
Well, I'm happy to hear that you're going to do this, because this is a powerful, powerful story, and it's positive, and it will be so helpful to so many people. And as we said, our interview is archived at iHeartRadio, so they have over 55 million subscribers. So this message will get out there. We can't exactly keep track of who hears it when, but once we archive it, it's there for anyone who needs this help and this advice. We have 1 minute. Do you have any regrets or things you'd like to do over?
Just wish I had seen this event coming, you know, so that I could have maybe prevented it or gotten my brother help. You know, for whatever was going on in his mind. And, you know, it's just that's really the only regret that I have. You know, there isn't much else I can say or do except continue on the path that I'm doing and know that I'm reaching out. And hopefully, you know, enough people hear this that it gets a positive response. I know everyone who's read the book says it's incredible, and they don't know how I could have done this and put that much of myself into it. To which I answer, if I didn't do that, then it wouldn't be worth its salt. So I keep moving forward, I keep paying it forward, and I keep trying to be there for people to explain that no matter how bad life is, there's always someone who's got it worse, there's always tomorrow, there's help out there for them, that they're loved, they're not alone, and, you know, this is just something that they can overcome with help.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you found your passion, and I've been very pleased to interview you today and share you with my many listeners. I hope you will come back, and I hope when you come back, we'll be talking about your upcoming movie.
That would be great. I would look forward to that, and I give you my word, it will happen.
Okay.
I will make sure that it happens, and I thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, give me your word that when it happens, you'll announce it here on my show.
Absolutely. Be happy to do that.
Wonderful. To my wonderful listeners, we hope you've enjoyed our show today. Hasn't it been an amazing show? Such a positive message and a sweet story. My upcoming guests for the show are all exciting, eclectic and energizing. They are clever, creative, and contagious. They will amaze, amuse, and astonish you. This is the show where you hear inspiring information that will help you to become successful. I'd love to welcome you to our No Whining World. You know, we really love sharing our stories, our struggles, and our secrets for success. It's our hope we can encourage all of you to emulate our guests today and every day. Remember my mantra, now if you think it, then you can do it. So for now, dear friends, please stop with the whining and then start smiling and then start sharing our show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, then start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. Again, thank you to my wonderful guest today, Carl David. This is January Jones, thanking you for joining me today on my journey and reminding you to take care and stay safe.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember,
your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.